Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Real Talk, a movie podcast. We are your go-to source for ratings and recommendations of past and present films. I am your host, Wes Jones, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Hey, this is Tommy, podcasting straight from Nashville, Tennessee.
The Movie Buddy Conway, podcasting from Bowling Green, Kentucky.
What's up, Real Talk community? Thank you for downloading today's episode. We're fresh off the heels of our second Guilty Pleasure series episode where we talked about 1995's Mortal Kombat with guest host and friend of the show, Preston Driver. And guys, how do you think that episode turned out?
Oh, spectacular. Who doesn't love Mortal Kombat? Preston knocked it out of the park. I mean, he came on the show and he killed it. But no, I think the audience will love it. You need to listen to it if you haven't yet.
Yeah, I mean, it was so much fun. Great to talk with Preston again, have him on the show. You know, ever since we did that episode, one thing I've really been doing in my apartment, you know, we're all quarantining and stuff. Remember that scene where that guy air kicked and air punched for like 30 minutes in a row? So I've been doing that a lot. That's kind of been my new routine. I do it even when I'm walking outside, all sorts of times. People look at me weird, but you know what? I just say, hey, have you not seen Mortal Kombat lately?
Well, I noticed you've been looking a little bit more lean. Look like you might have some muscles popping through that shirt that you're wearing today. So this must be it. This new Mortal Kombat air punching exercise routine you're doing.
Oh yeah, it's going to sweep. It's a sensation, and I can tell it's going to be awesome. My goal is to end up looking like what's that guy's name? Is it Goro? I can't even remember now.
Yeah, Goro.
So you want four arms?
Yeah, that's what I'm going for. I'm not saying I want to get there, Gabe. You know, we all have an image of where we're trying to get to. You know, don't body shame me. Is that what you're trying to?
This could be a thing. You know, like, you know, I have my things. Like, I invented Redbox and Kid Velcro. You know, this Mortal Kombat workout video could really be a thing.
Well, your things are fake, obviously. Else you wouldn't be on this podcast with us. So that's one thing. second of all, the Goro thing is real. That's the difference. So anyway, that's what I'm going for. Not saying I'm going to get there, but we'll see.
I think there's probably a plastic surgeon out in somewhere in California that would attempt to attach arms to you. Yeah. Now, they may not actually work. They might just hang there. But they would probably try it. That would have made a great episode of Nip Tuck.
I know, right? Surely there's like a TLC show I can get on, like forearm. This guy needs a two extra arms. Like, you know how it's always like that before and after? I want to be like that Goro guy. Before, after, me, Goro.
Before, two arms, after, four.
Four arms. Yeah, who doesn't want to watch? Who doesn't need four arms? You know, when I'm working, I can be two times as productive. Maybe I can get workers' comp. Maybe I can get my job to pay for it. I don't know. We'll see. A lot to, you know, think about. You know, 2021 is going to be a new year. This is my vision for that.
Well, we all know that if you did get the other two arms, all you would do is just air punch with those along with your other two, your regular arms. So you just have four air punching arms just going in your apartment.
Four air punching arms. That sounds amazing.
Well, let's get right into it. And honestly, I know the audience really doesn't even care much about the theme of our episode tonight. We know everybody has tuned in to hear Tommy Gunn's review of pig-headed horror film Tormented from 2014. So, T-Man, the floor is yours. Take it away. Let's hear your review.
Guys, I got... First of all, somebody was supposed to remind me about this pig-headed horror. I think I told you to be like, hey, remember after the episode, just make sure you all remind me about this. The reminding never came, audience. So Real Talk community, I want you all to know this is not my fault that I failed to live up to my promise.
Wait a minute. You don't have a review prepared?
Not yet, because I could have sworn we agreed on the last episode that I would do it. But I have short-term memory loss, obviously. I can't remember this stuff. And somebody was supposed to ride me, called Wes or Gabe. They didn't. So if anything, it's your all's fault in a lot of ways.
Hold on. I have some audio from our last podcast handy, believe that or not. I just keep it on me just in case. Let's see if we say anything about reminding. Hold on. Here we go.
running out of time, and I definitely don't want Jay to show up on my doorstep with that pig mask on. But I feel like that he might be into that. I'm not sure. So I'm going to watch it. All right, I'm glad he gave me that. You know, now I got the drive. Now I'm going to watch it. Jay, you're listening to this. I'm going to watch it, brother. I promise you.
All right, there we go. So we're on episode 18 again, which is going to be our Guilty Pleasure series presents Mortal Kombat. So when we episode 19, T-Man's going to have his tormented, pig-headed horror review ready for the audience, I think.
Oh, it's ready. I promise now. Now I've got it. I'm on it.
Well, I mean, there we have it.
Well, first of all, Real Talk Community, if you saw, a lot of my audio said, I will watch it. I didn't give a timetable. I didn't give a specified time when I had to watch it by. Now, at the end, I did say that. Pretty sure, though, that was altered audio. Didn't exactly sound like my voice. I couldn't be sure. I don't think I said that at the very end. So, all right, I'll come clean. I'll come clean, everybody. I forgot to watch it. And this is going to be a goal for next episode. Wes and Gabe are going to remind me this time, and I will have my brand new fresh review for Tormented next episode. Here's the thing. You all know, everybody that loves art knows this. You can't rush things. You can't rush this review that I'm going to do. I can't just, you know, it's got to come naturally. So that's what we're waiting on.
Episode 20, we're going to send the reminder. Episode 20, we're going to have this very well thought out a review, and it's going to be so good, we're going to refer to it as art.
Yes, it's going to be the first time a podcast review has ever be called art. We're getting close to that. Real talk. I know the wait has been hard. It's been tough, but it's going to be worthwhile when I bring that review to you all.
I'd be lying if I didn't say, I really hope you don't have the review, and we just do this at the beginning of every episode, and there's no review.
Well, it's starting to get that way. And here's this isn't a bit. I have literally forgotten it's time. So maybe next time I will remember.
Well, it's no secret. You know, you could classify all of us as cinephiles and lover of cinemas. We run a movie podcast, for crying out loud. And that's exactly what tonight's episode is all about. Our love for cinema. And considering it's Thanksgiving week, when we're recording this, I guess you could say we'll be sharing with you some of the movies that we're thankful for or that we love. So we have another new series called the Movies We Love series, which we plan to bring you every now and then. And I swear we've got more series than the Yankees. But we're at least bringing, you know, some different types of episode to you guys. So speaking of Thanksgiving, by the time you listen to this, Thanksgiving will have come and gone. I hope each of you had a great Thanksgiving. Hopefully you got to see a movie or two. And from all of us at Real Talk, we just want to say how thankful we are that we get to do this show. We're truly thankful for each of our listeners, all 10 of you. So this is how the episode is going to work tonight. Each host has picked a couple of movies they love and are going to recommend that our audience members go and check out. We're going to give you a good mix of genres here, with our choices, you know, truly a little something for everyone. And while we're talking through each of our movies, we're going to do so either spoiler-free or some mild spoilers, because again, these are recommendations for you to check out, and we don't want to ruin the stories. And then the final thing, based off the show tonight, if you go and check out any of these movies we love for the first time, or you simply just want to revisit a movie that you've seen before, please contact us. Tell us what you thought. It'd be so cool to hear from you, what you thought of our recommendation, and whether it's going to be a first-time viewing for you or a revisit. So with that said, guys, let's just jump straight into our reviews, and we'll get this episode going. And why don't we start with the movie, buddy, tonight? So why don't you kick us off?
Well, all right, Wes. You know, when we were tasked with this project, I tossed out a lot of ideas in the text thread, and you guys were kind of getting annoyed with me. You were like, Gabe, just decide on something, you know, just pick two movies. And I'm like, pick two movies? How do you just pick two movies to recommend to people? I'm the movie buddy. It's hard to pick two of my millions of movies that I'd ever seen. So Wes and them got tired of it, and you guys don't get to see the text thread. But I finally landed, and I made a decision. I was like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take my two favorite directors. So I picked Tim Burton, and I picked Ron Howard, spoiler alert for later on. And I picked the two movies that made me fall in love with each one of those directors. And I feel like it's going to turn out pretty good. So we'll start. I'm going to start with Tim Burton and his movie Big Fish.
In telling the story of my father's life, it's impossible to separate fact from the fiction, the man from the myth. The best I can do is to tell it the way he told me.
If there was one thing you can say about it, Boom Boom,
was that I was intended for larger things. I was the biggest thing Ashton had ever seen.
From the imagination of director Tim Burton.
Most men, they'll tell you stories straight through. It won't be complicated, but it won't be interesting either.
Did you ever think that maybe you're not too big?
But maybe this town is just too small?
All right. And so let's talk a little bit about the plot of Big Fish. The Big Fish plot basically comes from the perspective of an annoyed son who's listened to a collection of stories from his father, Edward Bloom, that he's told throughout his entire life. The stories are assumed to be either made up or exaggerated the whole movie. They're all a little quirky, and they're all a little crazy, but they're all very extravagant. And all the different things that he does throughout the movie are so extravagant, they're almost unbelievable things. And the movie takes place when he has to come back on a plane, and his father is close to passing away, and they start telling, and he starts telling these different stories because of different circumstances come up, you know, throughout the movie. And I gotta say, have you guys seen this movie? Because I think each of these stories are fascinating.
Yeah, Gabe, I've seen it. It's been a number of years, but I know I've seen it and I enjoyed it. I think I've seen it a couple times now, and it is a very Tim Burton. It's like peak Tim Burton in like his style and his story wise. But yeah, I've seen it and I enjoyed it.
I've seen it as well. Actually owned it for a number of years. And whenever, you know, you had said you wanted to do Big Fish for this episode, I went to go and watch it and it's not on my shelf. So I have no idea where the movie's at. Again, it's been so long since I've seen it. It's kind of hard for me to recall everything that takes place. But I did enjoy the movie, enjoyed it enough to buy it.
Well, let me tell you what it is about Edward Bloom. Some would call him a liar. Others would call him a glass half full kind of a guy with a creative imagination. That's what I choose to believe. Why do I love this movie? Edward Bloom is me. Edward Bloom is how I choose to think about the world. And I'm going to prove it to you guys throughout the podcast. I also think it's the way that Tim Burton thinks of the world. It may not be the most descriptive movie that talks about Tim Burton, but the way he creates his worlds with all of his movies, that's why I love Tim Burton so much. If you've ever watched Nightmare Before Christmas or Edward Scissorhands or just any of his movies, Beetlejuice, he creates an entire world that immerses you, and it can take you out of what you're doing and put you in the movie. So people my whole life have called me lucky, and they're just always like, good stuff always happens to Gabe. That's because a lot of times I tell them the stories, but I leave out all the grunt work because nobody wants to hear about that. You know, I'm married way up. I have two kids that amaze me daily. I've done a lot of really cool things in my life. There are little things that my friends would say that I just embellish a bit. Let me give you an example. Wes, if I was to tell you I'm almost at your house, how close to your house am I actually?
I would say that you're in your bathroom. You haven't even got your clothes off to hop in the shower yet.
Accurate. I'm trying to get a little bit better about that as I get older. Tommy, if I told you I won $100,000 in the lottery, how much did I actually win?
$100,000, maybe like $1,000.
Correct.
Even bought a lottery ticket.
Or I haven't even bought a lottery ticket, right?
Or I found $1,000. This is the world I live in, guys, and that's why I love this movie so much. You know, because so much of it is, I mean, I I make it real to myself, and it's so much more enjoyable living in this kind of world. You know, I love mixing imagination with the positivity that, you know, that something could actually happen. I think it's an awesome, outrageously quirky movie. And if you have not seen it, it has everything. It has everything from it has Siamese twins. It has people jumping out of airplanes. It has a whole town falling in love with a person. It has circus. It has everything. You know, so what I will say is directed by Tim Burton, where you can check it out. You can check it out on IMDb TV. It's free. If you have a Fire Stick or any TV that's considered to be smart, you know, just check it out. But that's basically it.
Well, I think it's a good recommendation, and it's not a movie that I think about very often. And I think that the average person that loves movies probably feels the same way. It's just something they don't normally think about. It was a hit. Like, it was well received, but it's not one that was a massive hit that tons and tons of people see, and they talked about it for years afterwards. So I think this is a great movie to recommend. If you haven't seen it in a while, I'm with Gabe. I say go out and watch it. I actually am going to take that advice myself once I can locate where the heck my copy of the movie went. And I can't really say why I like the movie so much without a big spoiler for the ending. Basically, the realization that character has at the end is what ties the whole story together, and it makes it so heartfelt. And again, don't want to get into that, but audience, once you watch the movie, if you've never seen it before, once the movie ties the whole story up in a bow, you're might well up just a little bit.
The realization is the same realization I hope my friends and my son and everybody that's listened to me talk, including you, the audience, you know, has when, you know, I pass away. And a couple of, like, quick fun facts.
We hope that's a while from now, Gabe.
Yeah, that's a while from now. But, you know, a couple quick fun facts that, you know, some of our audience will like. You know, Craig Smith listens, and Miley Cyrus, you know, that's her first role, was in Big Fish, fun fact. Fun fact number two, this is for T-Man. This is for you. Steven Spielberg almost directed it, but couldn't get scheduling right, and so it ended up being Tim Burton.
I can see that. It does have a Spielberg feel to it, but with that Burton twist. And Gabe, what I want to ask you, okay, it wasn't so much about Big Fish, but it kind of is. But I know you've known you for a long time, and I know that, you know, you've always talked about Tim Burton, about how, you know, he's your favorite filmmaker.
Oh, so I guess John Ed Wood.
Why did you pick Big Fish of all of his filmography? Was there a specific reason? Because I know he has a lot of great movies and a lot of movies we all love. So why of that one of the movies you wanted to love? Is it because it is kind of underrated and you wanted to expose it to the audience?
Well, first, it is the movie that I relate to the most, like I said. But, I mean, if I'm being honest, unlike T-Man with his review for Pigheaded Horror, when it is, I fell in love with movies later than Tommy and Wes. And so when I saw Big Fish, I think it was the first Tim Burton movie I ever saw. And from that point forward, I knew that I loved the worlds that he created. And I went back and I watched Edward Scissorhands, and I watched Beetlejuice, and I watched Nightmare Before Christmas, and I watched all of those, you know, different movies that he'd done. And I realized that this was the director that I love. Even Sweeney Todd, you know, all of his movies I genuinely enjoy. Even some of the ones that people don't, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah. I don't like that one. I'm glad you didn't pick that one.
Oh, it's not my favorite of his, but.
Okie doke. Well, that is Gabe's first recommendation. That is Big Fish from 2003. All right, T-Man, I'm going to cut in line. I'm going to go ahead and do our next review of tonight. And for my first movie, guys, I love this movie so freaking much. And my love for this movie continues to grow year after year. And I think it was probably just 2 or 3 years ago where I started to realize, man, I really, really like this movie. And I'm not even sure exactly why that I love the movie so much. It's not like that I relate to it. I just have so much fun watching it. It's a 1985 movie. It's classified as a straight horror movie. However, it just doesn't have that feel of a straightforward horror movie. It has a very 80s feel to it, which I mean in a good way. It's light. It's funny. It's unintentionally funny in some parts. It has high rewatchability, some awesome practical effects, interesting characters. So when you mix all that together, that is kind of the perfect recipe for a cinematic adventure to me. So my first recommendation tonight is Fright Night.
What would you do if you accidentally discovered the house next door was occupied by something not human? Something horrifying. Something unspeakably evil. No one believes you.
Mom, I didn't have a nightmare.
Not your mom.
They did kill a girl over there.
Not your girlfriend.
Charlie, is this some sort of a trick to get me back?
Not even the police.
Look, I know it's crazy. I know that, but look, Lieutenant!
It knows that you know. You'll do anything to protect yourself. But it will do anything to protect its secret.
And I would say that most of our horror fans have seen it, but I continue to come across people all the time that have never watched the movie. And the Wikipedia synopsis for the movie, which I'll expand on a little further as my review unfolds, the film follows young Charlie Brewster, who discovers that his next-door neighbor, Jerry Dandridge, is a vampire. When no one believes him, Charlie decides to get Peter Vincent, a TV show host who acted in films as a vampire hunter, to stop Jerry's killing spree. So to me, that's a pretty fun setup. And the first thing I've got to mention is Jerry. That is a hell of a name for a vampire. Good old Jerry the Vampire. Can you imagine running scared and when somebody's like, hey, what's wrong with you? And you're like, Jerry's trying to kill me. You know, their first thought would be Seinfeld? I mean, Springer. There's just not very many other Jerrys.
Springer popped into my mind.
Jerry Springer. Yeah. None of these people are threatening. Jerry Seinfeld's not threatening. Tom and Jerry, not threatening. Jerry Springer, not threatening. So anyway, that just cracks me up that the vampire's name is Jerry. We don't do this often, but I wanted to talk about the movie's poster. Because I've got to say, I just love the original poster art for the movie. And I will have, by the time you listen to this, used that poster art for some of our promotional material for the episode. But the poster shows a two-story house, a house similar to Charlie's, looking very isolated between a couple of large trees. In an upstairs window, a light is on. You see a small figure standing alone. And above the house in the clouds form a very scary, very menacing looking vampire face in the clouds. And it's just dwarfing the house. And in the movie, you find out that Charlie lives in a neighborhood. And the home, it's not isolated at all. But you can't tell that from the poster. However, Charlie's character in the movie feels very isolated because he can't get anyone to believe him that his neighbor is a vampire. So you have this huge threat right next door, yet he feels so small and so isolated against this powerful force. So again, it's just a great poster to represent the film. So I wanted to mention that. You guys know what I'm talking about with the Fright Night poster?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Sorry, Gabe, real quick. I love that poster because it's like it's so interesting. It's not indicative of the movie. Like, it's not like that's happening in the movie, but it's a great way to like kind of infer what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very evocative, I guess you could say. Yeah, but it's every time I've seen that poster, I'm like, that's a cool poster.
Well, I remember it as a kid as well, before I had ever even seen the movie, walking around Movies and More in Franklin, and I would always see that, you know, as I was going through the horror section, and it always caught my eye. I don't know why, but I just wanted to mention the poster in my review.
Well, I hate to disagree with Tommy real quick before you move on. I love disagreeing with Tommy. Hold on, let me back up just a second. I'm so glad I get to do that on here. It is indicative of the movie, because I rewatched that movie here recently, and man, that house has a lot of mist coming out of it. I mean, basically, that house just starts becoming enveloped in mist, and they're probably using 950 fog machines on that house. So I think the poster looks just like the house does in the movie.
There's not a vampire in the clouds. There's a vampire cloud above the house.
Well, that adds to the effect.
That's what I'm saying. That's not happening. If you saw the poster, you would think, oh, yeah, this is about a cloud vampire. Yeah, those are very dangerous vampires. Some of the most dangerous, mind you. I'm the vampire lord, by the way, one of my side hobbies. And cloud vampires are extremely dangerous. This is not about a cloud vampire. So that's what I'm saying. You know, it's not very indicative of the actual film.
But most of the time, it's like birds and things that have to be scared of cloud vampires or those on airplanes. But pretty much, you know, everybody else on the ground is safe. That's what you would think from looking at the poster.
Exactly, Wes. I've done a lot of research on this. The thing about cloud vampires is they are very two birds. And if you're in a plane, but the planes are usually pretty locked down. You know, if you got an open door in a plane, then yeah, cloud vampires can get in. But, you know, in the movie, they're not in the sky. Cloud vampires can't get in to the house. So that's why I just thought, like I said, this is just from me looking at the poster. I don't think it's a realistic expectation for the audience, because you're not getting what you want, what you thought you're going to get, which is those awesome cloud vampires.
See, this is why you just need a kind of a loose agenda for the show, because you get gold like that. Cloud vampires. This is going to be a new genre. We're pretty well connected with Hollywood. We'll shoot off a premise. Just say, okay, basically the poster of Fright Night, except for that cloud vampire stays up there.
Yeah. Yes. I feel like we can get Nick Cage as the cloud vampire.
I guarantee. I mean,
yeah, he's at the, you know, we'll just tell him that, hey, Nick, we invented Redbox. He's like, sign me up.
So back to Fright Night. But the movie was released on August 2nd in 1985, ultimately pulling in $25 million on a budget of just $8 to $9 million. So it was certainly successful, but again, it wasn't some major hit. It's certainly more popular now, I would say, especially in the horror community, than it was upon its initial release. And due to this, some people consider it a cult classic, but shameless drop of our cult classic episode, by definition, we established in that. I don't really consider it since, you know, again, it was well reviewed by critics, 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. And, you know, to me, that's surprising, because it isn't the type of movie that film critics usually would heap such high praise on. And for me, it's a little difficult to describe why the movie works. Again, it's very 80s. Charlie's girlfriend, played by Amanda Burse, looks more like his older sister or a young mother than his girlfriend. His best friend in the movie is very dorky and on the surface should probably get on your nerves, but for some reason he doesn't. He's kind of funny. He's like the comic relief. We've got seductive vampire stares. We've got 80s nightclub scenes. We've got subtle homoeroticism and some aged special effects. But the movie just works. And that little something that I can't fully describe to you is absent in the sequels and the remakes. And I think that's part of the reason why they don't work very well, especially the sequel. So who's involved in it? It was written and directed by Tom Holland. He's also known for his Psycho 2 screenplay. That's another recommendation from you. If you've never seen Psycho 2, that's actually a pretty solid movie, considering it came out 20-something years after the original Psycho. And Tom Holland, he also wrote and directed Child's Play. That's his other massive hit that he had. The movie stars 80s heartthrob Chris Sarandon, William Ragsdale, again, Amanda Burse, who you'll know as Marcy from Married with Children, Stephen Jeffries, and Roddy McDowell. So again, I said I would go just a hair deeper into the story. So Charlie is 17. He's a fan of horror films and of a local TV series called Fright Night, hosted by a former vampire hunter, Peter Vincent. And Charlie's room is upstairs in his house, and it literally faces the next-door neighbor's house, Jerry Dandridge, again played by Chris Sarandon. There's been some disappearances in the area. One night, Charlie discovers that Jerry is a vampire and is the one who's responsible for these disappearances. He goes to his mom, his girlfriend, his friend, the authorities. No one believes him. And it further complicates matters that Jerry knows that Charlie knows what's going on. And he starts to come around his friends and his family in a very threatening manner. But again, only Charlie is picking up on this. Charlie finally turns to Peter Vincent to help him. And I don't want to get into too much more of the movie because, as what I've told you so far, takes up about the first 30 minutes or so of the movie. We also get a lot of vampire tropes in the film, which I think the way that they use them is really unique. We get a little bit of a twist ending to the story as well, which is a nice cap on the overall story. And guys, I'll get your thoughts on it here in just a second. I just wanted to go, I've got a couple of notes just that I made on the movie that isn't really spoilers. But I love this idea of a horror fan who has a real life horror issue going on. And so when no one believes him, he goes to his local horror host for help. And horror hosts have long been popular, but were really popular in the 80s. You had Elvira, you had Svengoolie, you had Joe Bob Briggs, even Freddy Krueger, the character hosted, you know, where he was the horror host showing other horror movies. So myself as a horror fan, I just love that aspect of the movie that the horror fan thanks to go to his horror host because no one else will help him. So I love that.
Chris, hey, Glass, real quick. Don't forget for Scooby-Doo's it. Vincent Van Gool.
There, there you go. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't want you to brush over that.
That's another one. And then Chris Sarandon, again, who plays Jerry the Vampire, he had this quote about the film, and I really liked it. He said, "I thought this is one of the best scripts that I had read in a long time. Beautifully constructed. It was obvious that it was a labor of love. It was clear that the writer and director's approach to it was one of wanting to have fun with the genre without making fun of it. The characters were beautifully drawn." And I couldn't agree more. I thought his take on the movie is certainly why I love it. He's having fun in the genre, but he's not making fun. He's not making fun of vampires or horror films or creatures. He's just having fun with it. The visual effects team were the same team that worked on Ghostbusters. And I only mention that just because we did Ghostbusters a couple of episodes. So we definitely get some aged special effects, but we also get some pretty cool practical effects. There's a scene which a vampire gets a wooden cross burned into its forehead, which is just such a cool scene. And it created an iconic image for the movie. There's posters of that, and it's on the back of the box, I believe. It's just a really cool shot. The movie spawned a really bad sequel, Fright Night 2, which was a financial failure. Then in 2011, a Fright Night remake starring the late Anton Yelchin and Colin Farrell was released. It's decent. I went to go see it in theaters. Need to see that again. And then they followed that up by a foreign homage remake sequel called Fright Night 2 in 2013. Never seen that, never plan on it. And then for original Fright Night fans, and if you watch it for the first time and you become a Fright Night fan, Tom Holland, 77 years old now, recently announced he was writing a novel called Fright Night Resurrection with the goal that it becomes a film and it brings back many characters for the from the original movie as it can. And the final thing that I'm going to say about it is this is my all-time favorite vampire movie. And if you want to check out Fright Night, head over to Amazon Prime. It's on there now. And so, guys, let me bring you in here. What are your thoughts on Fright Night? Have you seen it before?
Well, yes, I've seen it. And you know what's so frightening about Fright Night? This is what I'll say for the audience. Wes alluded to it, but he said he has a real-life horror problem and nobody will believe him. So I say, and because that's frightening, like if a real-life vampire existed, nobody would believe you, and that's genuinely frightening to me. He has trouble getting his mom, his friends, everybody to believe him. I say right now, on air, we make a pact, and, you know, if we have a real-life vampire, we only tell the truth, and that way we have to believe each other. Between us three, if we have a situation like this, we come to one another. So I say we make that pact on air tonight. What do you guys think?
I'm in.
Well, yeah, T-Man's in, but here's the thing. If we make a pact, Gabe, I would believe you, even though you exaggerate stuff.
Yeah.
But T-Man, he doesn't just exaggerate. He flat out tells us he's going to do something and then doesn't do it. Ooh. So, like, how this pact is not going to go anywhere.
I mean, if our neighbor is a vampire, we just come to one another and we're going to have to trust each other from this point forward. What do you guys think?
I mean, guys, and trust me, if it's anything like this Tormented movie, you can trust me. word is my bond.
Good.
Yeah, Friday Night's a fun movie. Like you said, Wes, it is very 80s. So, like, you got to kind of, I always look at those 80s movies, especially the ones that are, like, very 80s. You kind of got to get in the 80s mindset. Because if you're not in the 80s mindset, they may not work as well. Because, like, you know, the music and the clothes and the cinematography, it's all just so 80s-ish. But that's kind of the appeal also. Because it is so, like, different than what you're seeing nowadays. You know, a lot of movies nowadays are kind of the same. This is totally different than that. So it's a lot of fun to watch. And also, I would just say that I love the premise. And Roddy McDowall is great as the horror host. And I think he kind of really makes the movie. You know, Roddy McDowall was in the original Planet of the Apes, a very well-known actor, and had a long career, but this kind of capped off his career. It was kind of like a beloved character that he could play towards the end of his career that a lot of people know him for. And I always thought that was really cool. And, you know, a lot of people, their first entry into Roddy McDowall is watching Fright Night. So, yeah, I would definitely recommend it if somebody hasn't seen, if they're a horror fan, and if they are into vampires, like you said, Wes, it's definitely a movie they should watch.
Peter Vincent, I guess, is the name in the movie, right? Vincent Price is the one that they originally approached to play that character. And Vincent Price, they got a hold of him, talked to him about it. He'd become so typecast by that point that he just didn't want to do anything else with horror. He was trying to do other things. I don't know if he regretted the decision to pass on it or not, but, I mean, for him and his legacy, it probably would have been good for him to have accepted this role. But again, Roddy McDowall got it, and he was just so good in it. I mean, he is definitely one. I mean, all the characters are really good. Chris Sarandon does a great job. William Ragsdale does a really good job. And then so does Roddy McDowall. So anyway, that's all I've got for Fright Night. And again, audience, love for you to check it out and let me know what you think. All right, T-Man, let's go. What's your first movie?
All right, guys. So my first movie is, I'm going to go with a more recent film. I'm going to go with 2018's First Man.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Be an Avenger.
First man to walk on the moon. That'd be something.
We've chosen a job so difficult, requiring so many technological developments, we're gonna have to start from scratch. Only after we master these tasks do we consider trying to land on the moon.
Neil, if his flight is successful, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
We're planning on the flight being successful.
If you all remember, this was the Neil Armstrong drama that came out, you know, towards the later end of 2018. It had a lot of buzz around it, had a lot of publicity. You know, it was going to be a major Oscar contender. It was Damien Chazelle's follow-up to La La Land, the film that he won Best Director for. It almost won Best Picture for, but Moonlight, you know, it had that whole kerfuffle there. And so this was looked at as like a major contender to, you know, be a player and to be a big hit. And if you all remember, it came out and then it got very controversial right when it came out. And we'll get into that here in a second. But I just want to talk about the film first. So the first thing about the film is it's really one of my favorite movies of the last few years for a lot of different reasons. And I know a lot of people haven't seen it, whether it was about the controversy or just because maybe it didn't look appealing or maybe, you know, just for lots of different reasons. But I think it's such an engaging, dramatic, you know, telling of this story. And let me give you a quick plot synopsis of it. So, hoping to reach the moon by the end of the decade, NASA plans a series of extremely dangerous and unprecedented missions in the early 1960s. So engineer Neil Armstrong joins the space program, spending years in training and risking his life during test flights. On July 16, 1969, the nation and world watch in wonder as Armstrong and fellow astronauts Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins embark on the historic Apollo 11 spaceflight. So, not giving anything away that they do end up flying, you know, landing on the moon. But I thought what was so interesting about this film, and it's such a great choice within it, is it's not what maybe you expect going in. You know, when you think of that plot, you're probably thinking of a movie like Apollo 13 or The Right Stuff. That's a very kind of rah-rah, like, you know, we can do it, that type of like all in and kind of like a man on a mission type movie. Whereas this is a much more personal journey. It's a lot, it's a really introspective, you know, drama in a way, because that's what Neil Armstrong was. He was basically an introvert and he had to not only kind of bear this burden upon himself. So in a lot of ways, it's a story. It's his story. It's a personal journey of him in just these crazy circumstances that nobody's ever done before. He had ever done this before. This was literally, he was the first man doing this. So I think that's such an interesting choice that they made for that. And then you take in that piece with the amazing actors. I mean, Ryan Gosling was just fantastic as Neil Armstrong. The direction by Damien Chazelle is fantastic. I mean, it's so visceral. It's so like kind of documentary, but also like personal and also very intense. It's even hard to describe. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a thriller in some ways. And then finally, I would say that the music is just flat out amazing. One of my favorite musical scores ever. I still do not know how it did not even get nominated for an Oscar. It's a crime. It's a travesty. It just shows you that the Oscars are usually wrong. And so that's just a little bit about the film. Wes, I know you haven't seen it, but I just want to kick it over to Gabe real quick, because I just pinned you on the film before I touch on the other thing within the movie. So, Gabe, off of what I just said there, is anything you wanted to add or your feelings on when you watched it?
Well, yeah. I mean, as you know, for a large portion of that year, and I think, yeah, that was my number one movie that year when I picked out my movie. So you know how much I love it. A couple things I want to touch on that you mentioned. One thing about it is, and he talked about like how alone, how this had never been done, how a lot of it's about the interaction with people and how he was kind of a loner. One thing that it shows right before the takeoff is the interaction with the family. And that is so intense, but it's also so realistic on how it must have been being in that house. And so you don't realize that a lot of the movie is going to be about that. And I think that that part of the movie is what makes it so good. That keyed in with the soundtrack playing during those, even during the beginning, but during while the flight's taking off, while they're in the air. I mean, it is flat out incredible. And so it goes from that like really emotional interactions with family to this really scary ride that they're on. And it just has something for everybody. So I would encourage everybody to watch it. If you haven't watched a Damien Chazelle movie, like Tommy said, he did Whiplash, La La Land. He knocks it out of the park every time. And I think this is his best movie. So that's all I have to say about it, but I love it.
Yeah, I think you're right, Gabe. And just how the technical virtue also of the filmmaking, and like there's a that sequence you're talking about with the space flight and the moon landing is incredible. Mm-hmm. But there's an earlier test flight he does, And it's kind of, I think it's the first time they dock ever in space. So it's the first time they dock because they had to get that test to ultimately dock and go to the moon. It was kind of like their last big test. Remember that sequence, Gabe, where it's like he's spinning out of control and he's about to crash. I mean, it is just so well done. And you're so like on the edge of your seats. And I just love it. And so, like Gabe said, it's a film. It's a really... it's a drama for sure, but it has those thriller elements. It's definitely an adult film. It's not a film, and maybe that's another reason why it didn't do as well. You know, a lot of people aren't used to watching real hardcore dramas anymore. They don't get made. This is a movie, in a lot of ways, I think, that would have been much more successful 30 years ago. You know, that when mid-level dramas were much more successful. Nowadays, a lot of people don't go watch them, you know, for whatever reason. You know, they'll get that stuff from TV. Not as much from the movies, but I think it's a shame that it just didn't do as well. So that's my recommendation on the actual film itself. And I wanted to kind of transfer over another discussion topic, because this is a topic I love to talk about with this film, because I hated it then and I still hate it now. And I'll discuss what I mean by this. Now we're getting into dangerous territory here, but I think I can tread this line pretty carefully. Because, you know, we've talked about, we're not going to get into political arguments on this show. There's too much of that out there already. But I think what we can all agree on both sides of the political persuasion, is what you would call outrage culture. That we have this sensationalized outrage culture before a lot of people even know what they're outraged about. A lot of people call it cancel culture in a lot of ways. And I think First Man was a victim of that cancel culture. And I think it was a shame it was, because I don't think it was accurate to the movie. And I don't think it was fair that it happened to it. So if anybody remembers when this first came out, there was a lot of controversy around it that it didn't show the American flag being planted on the moon, which is, of course, is a great achievement. And it's a great American achievement. It should. I mean, we should celebrate that. But here's the thing that I thought was disingenuous about that argument. That's not what the movie's about. If you want to see that type of film, the right stuff is your movie. As Gabe and I talked about, this movie's about his personal journey. And so when he lands on the moon, once again, this is not really giving anything away, it's about him on the moon. And it ultimately is about his daughter. So, and Gabe attested to me on that, that it's about that sequence and about him looking back at his family life. And so that's a filmmaker's choice that they went with. And so there's plenty of American flags in the movie. They talk about the NASA space program. It wasn't about that sequence then. And here's the other thing that I kind of want to speak on that about why I truly believe that. First, Damien Chazelle came out and said, no, that I didn't intend it to be like that. This was about him. It wasn't about that. There's a million other things you could have done in that sequence also. So I want to kind of discuss something with you all real quick. We've heard from the filmmakers saying this was not their intention. And if you really think about the movie, it makes sense why it didn't exactly show that. So is it fair then for a movie to get hit with that tag? So I guess the question I have for both of you is this. Is it matter what the artist's intention is? Or does it only matter what the audience's interpretation of it is? So if the movie didn't intend for that, should the audience then feel a certain way if that's not what they intended? Or is it fair to the audience to be like, well, I don't care what the actors and or what the filmmaker, especially the director, because that's who I really think is the source of this. I don't care what the director meant. This is what I felt. So what do you all think? And it doesn't have to be just about this. It's about any piece of artwork, any kind of feedback on that. What's your response to that?
Well, let me start by saying this, because I have not seen First Man, but yet I knew a lot about the controversy that was going on. And me personally, I did not have a problem with what Damien Chazelle said and or what he intended the movie to be about. That I didn't have any issue with that. And I know he was part of that and kind of called out that he should have put that in the movie and he didn't. And I, like you said, they show the American flag plenty of times in the movie. I didn't have any issue with that. The issue that I had, or what I didn't like to hear, and I know that it did affect the movie's box office, I think, because of this particular thing. Plus, it was probably blown out of proportion. But after this got going, Ryan Gosling was in an interview. Ryan Gosling is Canadian, and we have Canadian friends of the show. I have zero, absolutely zero issue with Ryan Gosling as Canadian playing, you know, this important American figure. It's no problem. Ryan Gosling is a great actor. But whenever he was asked about this, rather than saying, to try to say, no, that's not, just like Damien Chazelle did, rather than backing him up, he kind of doubles down on this thing that, well, it wasn't just an American achievement. It was a world achievement. And I kind of understand what he was going for when he was saying that. The problem is that if you go back to that time, back in the late 60s, this was a huge race between countries, especially the U.S. and Russia, to who could pull this off first. And there was a lot of pride in our country and then also in Russia behind this whole thing. So when the United States got there first and was the first nation to put a man on the moon, our country celebrated it as an American achievement, not as a world achievement. Now, so many years later, yes, that, I mean, just the fact that human beings were able to get to the moon is pretty, and walk around up there is pretty spectacular. But that was my only kind of issue with it, is that I felt like a lot of this is on Ryan Gosling's shoulders for, instead of just backing up his director, he kind of doubled down and just took it a step further, and that caused the outrage to go a little bit further. So that was just kind of my opinion. It had, that is not the reason why I have not seen First Man. I actually saw it on the shelf at a going out of business sale from a local family video, and I was in there just picking up some cheap movies, but they only had it on DVD, and I don't want to buy a new movie on DVD, even if it is just $3 or $4. So I'll eventually watch it because I really, really like Whiplash. That movie is fantastic. And then I like La La Land a lot too. I thought it was a good musical. Again, you've heard me on this podcast before. I am not a huge musical fan, but I did enjoy La La Land. And then T-Man, back to your original question. Most of the time, this type of stuff does not cause controversy. I mean, if you think about it, like Stanley Kubrick, as an example, he is a director that would always, I don't even know what the heck he intended half the time, because his art in the movie was to pretty much let the audience decide and pull what they want to pull from it. That's why we're still talking about 2001 The Space Odyssey 50, 60 years later. That's why we're still talking about The Shining and what the heck that ending meant, you know? So I think ultimately it doesn't really matter what the director intends. It's always going to be about what the audience gets out of it, whether they liked it, whether they disliked it, whether they had some big epiphany because of the movie. People are generally just going to latch on to how they think and how they feel about a movie. But I'm with you. First Man did take a kind of an unnecessary hit. Some of it was because of this culture that we have going on that needs to stop. And then some of the other is because, you know, you kind of had an actor that should have just director and just said that. There's no political, there's yep. nothing to it.
And feedback on that. And I agree with you, Wes. That got Ryan Gosling. It was stupid. It's not true what he said. But at the end of the day, I look past that because I always go back to the director. To me, the director is the source. Like, actors are notoriously airheaded. They're actors. They're empty vessels. A lot of them don't know a lot. The director, to me, is the one that's kind of the key. And when Damien Chazelle came in and said all that, then, you know, that made me understand, okay, that's what he was going for there. And when to me, watching the film, if this was never a controversy, I don't think I would have never even thought about it, because that's not the vision of the film. Well, because that's why we say there is already that film. That film was already made. It's called The Right Stuff, and it's a great movie. If you want that film, watch that movie. This is another type of film, also equally as good, about his personal journey, about what it would take to actually do this. And that's really what the movie's about. What it would take mentally, physically, and then on a person's family to actually be the first man on the moon. And sorry to cut you off, Gabe.
I hear all these different things about movies and different perspectives and reasons people won't see it. I don't like that kind of thing. You know, I can name hundreds of, you know, circumstances on both sides of the political spectrum. Always go see it. Always develop your own opinion about a movie. Because if nobody had said it, that when I got out of the movie, I talked to Tommy about it. That wasn't about America's journey to the moon. It was a character study on Neil Armstrong. I think that movie was more of a character study about the person. So, like, I'm a proud American. I would have loved to seen a flag planted in the moon. I was, you know, I'm very proud that, you know, to live here in a wonderful land. But I almost think it might have taken away from the movie even, because it wasn't about that. In that circumstance, it was about Neil Armstrong's journey to the moon. But Damien Chazelle said that wasn't even his intention. So, you know, that's why I think you have to go. Don't listen to the hoopla and develop your own personal opinion, because you may miss out on movies that are spectacular because you are being too involved in, you know, what was said and what happened.
Yeah, exactly. And just to kind of put a bow on, I think you all are both right. I think, you know, at the end of the day, avoid the circus out social media or the controversies, because a lot of that's what it is. It's just controversy for controversy's sake. It's just to get click. It's clickbait. Go and watch the movie, decide for yourself. And then hopefully, you know, audience out there, if you haven't seen it, whether it's because of this or something else, give it a shot and let us know what you think.
Well, we got a little heavy here. I'm going to have to sit back up straight.
This
whole thing, it was weighing me down a little bit, but just audience, so you know, real talk, we can do it all. We can talk about anything in regards to movies. So let's mix this round up. I'll go ahead. Let me kick us off here. My next recommendation, what cracks me up is we're going to go from First Man to this. So great transition, Wes. But this movie is classified as an action horror film. So, yes, I chose two horror movies to represent my horror community, because although both are vastly different types of horror movies, I knew my counterparts here were not going to go down the horror path, and I had to keep us on that, you know, fresh off our all of our Halloween stuff. I stumbled upon this movie back in 2002 when it was released on DVD. I was walking around a Blockbuster video, if anyone remembers those. The girl I was dating at the time and I were trying to find something good to watch. And a movie box, it caught my eye on the shelf. And this is the slogan. And this is what I read before I even saw the title. Jaws, Aliens, and Predator with a werewolf twist. Boom. Done. Like, I didn't have to look any further. I pulled that off the shelf. And then after watching the movie, I'm not quite sure where the Jaws part comes in, other than both werewolves and shark have shark teeth. But I can definitely see the Alien meets Predator with a werewolf angle. And I'm talking about the Neil Marshall-directed British film Dog Soldiers.
One of the most explosive, brutal, and purely enjoyable horror debuts since The Evil Dead. Genuinely frightening. Jaws, Aliens, and Predator with a werewolf twist.
Come on!
Dog Soldiers. It'll blow your house down.
And guys, this is a badass movie. You know, where Fright Night had its humorous side, Dog Soldiers is played very straight with a few moments of that dry British humor sprinkled in, which I know T-Man and I really appreciate that kind of dry humor. Gabe, I've never really heard you talk about it. I don't know if you do or not, but I do like that dry British humor.
I'm a huge fan of Shaun of the Dead and all those movies, so yes, I love it.
Well, the movie buddy has never seen this, but Gabe, with that tagline, think about it. Jaws, Aliens, and Predators with a werewolf twist. That's you, man. That's creature feature galore.
You should
get that tagline tattooed on your arm.
That's okay. I mean, you've sold me just with that one line. Like, I'm about to hang up on this podcast call and just watch it.
Well, audience, if the name Neil Marshall sounds familiar, He also directed another genre classic, The Descent, which we'll cover at some point in the show because that is also an all-time movie for me. So the synopsis for Dog Soldiers, and I'm going to take this from IMDb, and it's just one sentence. A routine military exercise turns into a nightmare in the Scotland wilderness. So let's go to the Wes Jones version instead. Six soldier squad is doing a training mission in Scotland Highlands against a special air service unit. And they stumble across the shredded remains of that SAS unit. They realize the dire situation that they're in, and they start trying to retreat and get out of there, having no clue what they're up against, what has happened to this SAS unit. And the story, it also mixes in a siege narrative for a portion of the movie. You really have basically a third of the movie is this kind of open wilderness, and then the last two-thirds are more of this siege narrative. So you get big chunks of the movie that are pretty different from one another. And here are my notes from the film, and I'll just walk through these. The movie has a very nice opening scare scene with a couple who's camping. And this is a bit cliche, as it's been used over and over in both slashers and creature features, but it's still very well done. The movie, it's truly action-packed and intense, and the director was really big on making this an action meets horror story. And that sets it apart from most of the werewolf movies that we are all familiar with. In another way that the film goes against the grain for other werewolf movies is that there isn't some tragic individual at the heart of the story. You know, no guy's bitten and then has to cope with his body changing and him going through, undertaking this change in his body and the harm that he's causing others. And maybe he ate his friend or killed his neighbor. You know, there's none of that. Also, the werewolves in the film, they aren't preying upon helpless or ill-equipped people. You know, they're up against soldiers and heavily armed soldiers at that. And the idea is used so effectively in both Predator and Alien. So if you like those movies, this is kind of that third movie that does that. But it's still very different from those two movies. I really like the look of the werewolves that are in the movie. They're very tall, they're muscular, they have large heads. And especially towards the beginning of the film, we barely see anything. And that's used so effectively. Too many times in scary movies, they show way too much of whatever it is that is after our protagonist. And it just makes it unscary. And then sometimes it'll be scary for the whole movie. And then at the end, they will show the creature or whatever it is. And it kind of ruins it. And Mama, the guy that made it, I can't think of his name right now. But that was his movie, and it was so good up until the end, and then they showed this CGI blob, and it just sucked and ruined the movie. And that design of those werewolves I was talking about was actually, it was sketched by one of his friends. They just sketched it on a piece of paper and turned it into him, and he was like, man, I love this. And then they designed the creatures. So I already told you earlier that my favorite vampire movie was Fright Night. And in my opinion, Dog Soldiers, this is the best werewolf movie of all time. And if you're thinking, yeah, but your opinion's probably crap, here are my top five werewolf movies. So you be the judge. Dog Soldiers, number one. The Howling, number two. American Werewolf in London, number three. Wolfman, number four. And then I really like Underworld as well, would be number five. Now, I know it's a vampire and werewolf mix, but it still counts. So those are my top five. So I think that's a pretty solid top five for werewolf movies. So if you haven't seen Dog Soldiers, you got to do it.
What about American Werewolf in Paris?
Yeah. That did not make even my top 100.
All right.
Fine.
Fair.
So you guys will probably find this interesting, but Simon Pegg, back before anybody knew who Simon Pegg was, and Jason Statham were both attached to be at the movie. And they were not people that they just wanted and hoped for. They were actually attached to be in the movie, but it took so long to get this movie off the ground. Neil Marshall started conceiving the plot in 1995, and it wasn't released for 7 years later. They eventually lost both of these guys to other projects. And apparently the dialogue is very realistic, as that's how apparently the British Army speak to one another. So our American ears, or at least mine, I didn't pick up on everything that they were saying the first time I watched the film. So I would recommend, you can obviously understand what's going on and they're talking, but sometimes it's very kind of that British slang. I would read subtitles on the first time that you watch it. I'm going to give a little warning for the movie. It's not really a spoiler, because as you can imagine, an action movie with werewolves, there's going to be some violence in it. But there's a really rough entrails scene in the movie, which is very famous among Dog Soldiers fans. And it was accomplished by, they took like this intestinal skin and they filled it full of sausages to make it. And apparently it smelled terrible. And the actors in the movie just hated it, but it was such, it looks extremely real in the movie. And then the final thing, for any fans of the movie, we've been teased for nearly 20 years now of a sequel. We even got a title at one point, I think way back in 2004, called Dog Soldiers Fresh Meat. Just 3 to 4 weeks ago, Neil Marshall said that there is a better chance now of a sequel happening than ever before. So for us Dog Soldiers fans, that's great news. And you can check this movie out on several streaming services, but I couldn't find it anywhere streaming for free. It's going to cost you $4, but it's completely worth it. Guys, what are your thoughts on Dog Soldiers? Has anybody seen it? Well, Gabe, I know you haven't. T-Man, you seen Dog Soldiers?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I know I saw it when it first came out, Wes. I think I've seen it another time also. And like you said, I think the best way to describe it is it's just a badass movie, man. It's just like Predator. It's like Aliens. It's in that vein. And I love these type of action horror films. That's kind of what I call it. And I love those type of films because they're not super scary, but they're just fun. They're kind of over the top a little bit. You just have a great time. Wes, you know, Gabe, you know, I love to watch B-grade horror sci-fi movies on a Friday night. Like tonight, that's what I'll do. I'll go to HBO Go and I'll see what type of horror sci-fi movie I can watch. It's just what I call my like Friday night horror movie night. And this is like the perfect example of what I'm looking for. If I could find a Dog Soldiers every Friday night, I'd be in heaven, because it's like an undiscovered gem. You know, it's like something you didn't know a lot about. You don't have high expectations for it. But then when you watch it, you're like, oh, this is a cool movie. Lots of fun. Really glad I watched it. And like you said, I can't believe they haven't done a sequel. They do sequels to everything, I feel like. How have they not done a sequel yet? That amazes me.
I don't know. One of the actors said that, he goes, I have probably in my life been approached by a million different fans of this movie. And that's the question they ask me every single time. When are we going to get a sequel to this?
Yeah.
So hopefully it'll happen. As long as Neil Marshall is attached to, he's very story dependent. He has to have a really good story to make a good movie, because he sometimes gets some stories that aren't very good and his movies aren't very good. But he is a talented filmmaker, and as long as he's attached and they come up with a good story for it, it could definitely be good.
Well, Wes, he reminds me of that John Carpenter quote when we met him at our college, Western Kentucky University. He said that some filmmakers are shooters.
Yep.
Neil Marshall is a shooter. He's not a story guy. He's just a pure visual guy where if he gets a good story, he can make a good film. And I can kind of see what Neil Marshall is saying now, because, you know, Neil Marshall had this was like kind of a minor cult hit. He had The Descent, which is another, you know, horror hit. But then he made Doomsday, which was kind of a disaster, a big
bomb.
Did you
go see that with me? I can't remember. I
saw it.
It sucked.
Like a really poor man's version of Road Warrior. It's really bad. But he kind of had like a career, I guess, you know, his career wasn't doing so hot. But then he got involved with Game of Thrones, and he became famous for doing some of their best episodes. So he did the very famous Blackwater episode from season 2. He did the, what's the episode about the Night's Watch? I think it's in season 4. I can't remember what it's called, but it's one of their big famous battle episodes. I think it's season 4. So he became kind of one of their go-to big time directors, and that really revived his career in a lot of ways. So I think there's a good shot that we are going to get a sequel to this, which would be a lot of fun.
Well, I think what got him the Game of Thrones gig is I'm pretty sure that he did the little B-movie Centurion with Michael Fassbender. And I own that movie. I actually like it quite a bit. It's pretty violent, and it also has a few things that obviously are not of that time period, which would throw you off a little bit by watching it. But it's worth a one or two times watch. Now that I'm thinking about it, I'm not sure why I own it, because I don't really have a desire to see it again. So, audience, we may just give that away as part of this episode.
Who watched Centurion? Everybody's like, not nobody.
Nobody signed up for the giveaway.
Well, but anyway, no, Gabe, I seriously think you would like this movie. It is just a fun movie. And that's what I wanted to do tonight, is just come out with a couple of fun horror films that a more of a wide audience. Like if I came in with Black Coat's Daughter or something like that, I think most of the audience would hate me if they started watching that, even though I love that movie. But again, let's continue to mix it up. Let's go back to T-Man, and then we'll have Gabe take us home.
All right. Thanks, Wes. So I went a little heavy last movie, so I'm going a little lighter, kind of in a different direction. So what I want to kind of talk about now is one of my all-time favorite films. So when Wes said, you know, let's you know, this was kind of his idea, let's do an episode about movies we love. First Man was one that popped my mind first off, because kind of just the same things we talked about. But then I really wanted to talk about a movie that is like one of my all-time favorites, a movie that I truly love, but maybe doesn't get talked about a lot anymore. Kind of, I guess, I don't want to say forgotten, but it's just one of those movies that not everybody thinks off the top of their head when they think of great films. And that is Last of the Mohicans from 1992.
It's not as I imagined it would be, thinking of it in Boston.
The frontier is the only land available to people. Out here, they're beholden to none.
As a new land was being carved out of an untamed frontier.
Just dropped in to see how you boys is doing.
One man, defiantly courageous, stood his ground.
I called all our colonial scouts. What in the militia?
I ain't your scout. You sure ain't no damn militia.
One woman, fiercely independent, followed her spirit.
My father warned me about people like you. He said, do not try to understand them. Do not try to make them understand you.
Thank you so much.
They shared an adventure.
It was a war party. That means they're going to be attacking up and down the frontier.
That took them from the edge of the wilderness.
He saved us. We're alive only because of him. Are those the actions of a criminal?
And into each other's hearts.
So this is a Michael Mann film, who is, I think, one of the best filmmakers, at least of the past, you know, 30 years, and one of my personal favorites, and starring one of the great actors of all time in Daniel Day-Lewis. So the plot, of course, from a book, if anybody's read that, is that the last members of a dying Native American tribe, the Mohicans, Uncas, his father, Chingachgook, and his adopted half white brother Hawkeye live in peace alongside British colonists. But when the daughters of a British colonel are kidnapped by a traitorous scout, Hawkeye and Uncas must rescue them in a crossfire of a gruesome military conflict of which they wanted no part, which is the French and Indian War. So that kind of sets up the plot. But here's the thing about Last of the Mohicans. The plot is not really what's in the important piece of it. I consider this a pure director-like film. Like, the pure filmmaking talent of Michael Mann makes this movie. And this is the movie that I would show anybody that's like, okay, how good is Michael Mann at directing? I would show him this movie, because it is just such a blast and such a filmmaking achievement. But here's a couple. One of the first things I want to talk about with Last Mohicans is this. Is what type of filmmaker thinks of making a movie like this, but making it in like that MTV style? Like, do you all remember in the late 80s and early 90s, there was that trend of films that came out that kind of were all in that MTV vogue, I guess you can say. You had The Lost Boys. I know, Wes, that's one of your personal favorites. Point Break is like that. And then Last Mohicans is kind of like the apex of that. It's like that sweeping action melodramatic, but it's got the music, which is almost kind of a rock score. It's got like the punk rock, Daniel Day-Lewis. And it's just like, it's what you would call that MTV style filmmaking, which basically Michael Mann kind of invented with Miami Vice. That's kind of his, what he's known for. So when I rewatched the film not too long ago, I was just kind of blown away about how, you know, they always say they don't make movies like this anymore. They really don't make movies like this anymore, because it is just such a beautiful film and such an exciting movie. Like, it's just all action the entire time. Like, there's not a lot of just standing still. And it's such a realistic movie, too. It really makes you think you're back into that time period of the late 1700s. So it's a really interesting dichotomy of, you've got the MTV style action and filmmaking style, but also it's super realistic. So before I get into some other points, I just want to kind of throw it to you guys. Have you all seen this movie? Have you seen it recently? And what are your thoughts on it?
I've seen it recently. I love this movie. I've brought up that the score is what kills this movie, and I always like to bring it up before Tommy does. I mean, the last sequence.
Don't do it.
With the score going and everything, you know, I noticed it first, and I told Tommy about it. I was like, you got to check out this movie. The score really elevates this movie. Nothing is like.
Oh, Gabe, I've been talking about this last 20 minutes of this movie for like years, and I hadn't even got to that. I was getting to it, and Gabe talked about it.
I had to do it. Like, because I'm the one who told you. I remember sitting you down. We were at college. So I said, Tommy, you got to check out the end of this movie. It's spectacular. The score really starts hitting climaxes while the climax is hitting. It's like, boom, you're out of your seat. Let me tell you, some other movies have tried to do this and epically, I mean, they didn't fail. The closest movie I can think of to this is Apocalypto. It's pretty good. It's a pretty good movie. It's kind of like this movie, but yeah. This movie just outshines it. But
well, okay. To that point, and I will say, yeah, we have talked about the ending. The last 20 minutes of the movie is just, I know we talked about earlier, Wes, about badass. This last 20 minutes is just badass. I mean, and that's what I mean by also the MTV style filmmaking, because the last 20 minutes is literally just a music video. That's all it is. It's just music, action, music, action. There's very little dialogue. And you're just like pumped up. You're like on the edge of your seat, standing up. You're just like, oh, the emotion is just like getting so high. And it's a big chase film in a lot of ways. And we're not really getting even into the plot, because like we said, the plot's important, but there's twists and turns, and I don't want to give too much away. So Wes, kick it over to you real quick. Have you watched the film recently, and what are your thoughts on it?
I have not seen the movie recently. I do own this one. And I really like this movie. Michael Mann, for me, is a little hit and miss. But whenever he's on his hits, they are great movies. Like, obviously, everybody thinks of Heat when they think of Michael Mann. But, you know, I like Collateral a lot that came out in 04. I like Thief, which was his very first movie. You know, he did Manhunter, and he did a lot of different movies. But Last of the Mohicans is definitely one of his top movies. Again, you mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis earlier. Probably, well, it's not probably. He is one of our greatest actors that we've ever had. And I remember that ending as well. You know, there is so much action. And I love Daniel Day-Lewis's look in this movie, too, because he plays a white man that was, I guess, adopted at a young age by the Mohican tribe, but he just looks, he has that look that he belongs there. He's got the long black flowing hair and his outfit that he wears. And, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis, what's so great about him is that I almost feel like he's unrecognizable in this particular role. Like, take this role and then take like Bill the Butcher, and put those two guys side by side. And the movies are only 10 years apart. He looks nothing like that. And he just creates this just action hero type character that's based on a true story. And then what's interesting about the book is that I heard the book really sucks. Like, it's really boring.
I've heard that too. I've never read it. Yeah,
I haven't either. But I heard that the book sucks. And what's so crazy is you got Michael Mann sitting there. He's, again, Thief, Manhunter. I don't know what else he did before this, but he's established right by this point. And then he's like, I don't know if he came up with it or somebody told him about it, but it's like, hey, there's this really boring, sucky book. We think you should make this movie. And then he turns it into, it's not boring at all. Like you said, it's just like there's action throughout. There's story. You know, there's romance in the movie. Madeline Stowe is the love interest in it, right?
Yeah.
And she's a great character in the movie. And we've got a third party who is vying for her love as well. And that, to me, that whole situation is really interesting to the plot. I don't want to give too much away, but what happens, you know, with those three characters and how all that plays out towards the end of the movie. So, no, I love this choice. We've been told several times that, you know, y'all agree too much on this. We need some parity. We need some, you know, some people back and forth a little bit. Like, people have said that. But it's just like the movies we continue to choose. It's hard not to like them, you know. Yeah. And I can't see anything bad about Last of the Mohicans. Highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Wes, about kind of Michael Mann and everything you're saying about the movie. The thing about Michael Mann is he's kind of known as a perfectionist and a madman in some ways. Like, he's always such a, like, you can see that in his films. So much almost information in the film. Like, Heat is so technically accurate about that world. And in Mohican's movies is just the same way. It's so lived in, and it's so like you're so there, and it's such a beautifully shot film. The last thing I want to kind of just talk to you guys about real quick is, okay, so Day-Lewis, Wes, I'm glad you brought him up. Of course, fantastic in the film. He is known as a method actor, and apparently he went a little crazy in this film, as method actors tend to do. So apparently he would carry his long musket around everywhere he went, even to apparently Christmas dinner. He built canoes. He would skin animals, like, while on set and in preparation for the movie. Apparently he's a smoker. He would not smoke his regular tobacco, but he would only roll tobacco that they would have rolled back then. So he had to learn how to actually roll his own to actually like they would have done back in the 1700s, which, if you know Daniel Day-Lewis, like the stories about him, none of that surprises me. So I just wanted to kind of last question to you all. This isn't really about the film as much. It's just kind of an interesting thought I had, is like, do you really think method acting, and this may be a longer discussion we should have, is it necessary, or is it all kind of goofy? What's your first reaction to all that?
Before I go into that question, I just picture Daniel Day-Lewis at the front of a McDonald's with his musket in his hand. Hey, can I have a number one? Hold the mayonnaise on that number.
Sir, no guns in here. This is my musket, lady.
I'm getting into character here, and like, everybody's frightened, like running from him. I don't know. Sorry. But no, I think, you know, all of the method actors that say they are method actors, though, they produce some of the best performances. Like, I think Heath Ledger in Dark Knight, that's probably not method actors are, and Daniel Day-Lewis has always been a method actor, and he is spectacular in every role that he ever does. Yeah. So maybe it is necessary. I don't know. Maybe it
does get results. Wes, what do you think?
Well, I don't think that Heath Ledger for the Dark Knight is really a method actor. What he did was that, you know, Jack Nicholson talked to him and kind of warned Heath Ledger about this particular role. It's like, you know, if you want to get true to the role, you really have to tap into something dark. And so what Heath Ledger did is that he kind of locked himself in a hotel room and he studied and tried to perfect this character. So I don't think that he was, you know, on set and everywhere he was in that character.
True. Yeah.
To your point, quick, just off that, if anything, Jared Leto went method acting for his role in Suicide Squad, apparently, and he was like sending his co-stars rats in the mail or something. And we see what the result of that was, which was
right. That is not the best result.
So maybe it depends on the actor. Maybe you have to actually be a good actor for it to work. I don't know.
Well, here's why I know I could never be an actor is because I would be unhirable in Hollywood because I would punch. I would get in a fight with literally every method actor on set because they would just get on my damn nerves. It's like, okay, like you can be a great actor and not do this crap that they do. Like, can you imagine, like, you guys just had a hard day, you know, the scenes got real intense and it's like, but you knew as a crew, you knocked it out of the park. And then you just wanted to hang out just for a few minutes after it was over, you know, you're walking back to your trailer or you're going to get something to eat. And it's like, you know, DDL over here, he can't stop being Hawkeye from Last of the Mohicans just to have a normal conversation. Like, you know, I would want to pull that musket out of his hand and just hit him over his head with it to try to bring him back into reality.
I know. I think you're it's so true. Like DDL, you're going over there. You're like, hey man, can I get a Camel smoke? He's like, no, only got 1750 vintage roll tobacco over here.
I've only got a corn cob pipe.
So yeah. I think there is truth to it. I think you can see, of course, a lot of our great actors, especially from, you know, the 70s new wave, a lot of them are method actors and they delivered amazing performances. But then when you hear about it, it also sounds kind of goofy. So it's just kind of fun to think about. Yeah.
What I will say, because you can't just roll out of bed and be an actor. Like most people cannot. There's a very few people that just have the natural gift who can do it. But most people, they have to, it's a craft, right? And you have to perfect that craft. And I do appreciate when actors push themselves to extreme limits for roles. Matthew McConaughey in Dallas Buyers Club, all the weight transformations Christian Bale has done, Leonardo DiCaprio, all the crazy stuff that he did for The Revenant. Basically, you know, he had huge insurance policies on him for eating that buffalo liver or, you know, being up in Canada in winter and laying in that stream of water. You know, they thought he was going to kill himself for the role, but it was one of his best roles he's ever done. Like, I appreciate people that go like push their physical limits for a role because they typically turn out really, really well. But now once we say cut and things calm down a little bit, I still don't need that guy to still be trying to act like him.
Look,
yeah,
guys,
I think that's, yeah, go again.
This is really important. Like, you guys didn't know this about me, and I haven't told anybody yet, so I was kind of keeping this under wraps. I am the first method podcaster. Basically, I go around, and everybody I talk to, I pretend I'm on Real Talk, a movie podcast. Like, I'll go up to McDonald's, and I'll be like, hey, welcome to Real Talk, a movie podcast. How's your day going? And I feel like that's why I'm the best performer on the show. Like, I didn't want to tell you guys that I was doing that, but, you know, it kind of came. We were talking about it. It was in the theme. So have you noticed the difference?
No, well, I've only noticed the difference when we're talking not on the podcast.
Right. That's when I noticed the difference.
Yeah, right, because you keep referring to the audience that's listening, and I'm like, Gabe, it's just you and me, man. But, you know, so, yeah, now it's all starting to make sense.
Yeah, okay. Glad I told you.
So I just want to wrap it up real quick. If you haven't seen The Last Mohicans, of course, definitely go out and watch it. It's going to be an awesome night. It's such an action-filled. It's like an action drama. That's the best way, with some romance in it also. If you haven't watched it recently, go and watch it again because it definitely holds up. And it's one of those films that you're going to be like, wow, that was really good. And it's like one of those, it's like, wow, you're right. They don't make those like they used to.
Well, we're on to our last review of the night. And Gabe, you bookended us. You started us off. Now take us home.
Well, Wes, I'm catching on to you. Did you not like my movie Rush? Is that why you pushed it to the back?
Possibly.
There's a lie that all drivers tell themselves. Death is something that happens to other people. And that's how you find the courage to get in the car in the first place. But more powerful than fear itself
the will to win.
Listen, if we got any ladies left, you know, you're in luck. We got Chris Hemsworth in this movie. Wes told me not to say that, but I mean, our one fan left just got excited. So let me tell you a little bit about the plot. In the mid-1970s, the charismatic English playboy James Hunt, or Chris Hemsworth, and an Australian perfectionist, Niki Lauda, share an intense rivalry in Formula One racing, driving vehicles that are little more than gas-filled rolling bombs. Hunt and Lauda burn up the track, and all while pushing themselves to the breaking point of physical and mental endurance. Meanwhile, women, their two women, watch as these two drivers risk their lives. Let's start, guys. First of all, I don't like Formula One racing. I don't know anything about it. I wasn't alive in 1976. Nothing of this magnitude has ever happened in racing in my life, so I have no interest in anything like this. I've sold you guys on the movie, right?
Yeah, you sold me, Gabe. I'm hooked.
Yeah, don't like Formula One racing, hate it. Anyway, so that's how good this movie is. I love it when a movie takes a topic that I could care less about. I sit down and I watch it, and it's one of my favorite movies. The movie's so fun to watch. And part of it is because of Chris Hemsworth and I always forget the other guy's name, Daniel Brühl, which Daniel Brühl knocks it out of the park in this movie as Niki Lauda. I didn't know Niki Lauda, but after researching him a little bit, like, he knocks it out of the park, and they both kind of look like the characters. In fact, if you watch this movie, you should look up the characters because the whole cast looks like all of the characters that they were playing. So one of the characters is like the super playboy. That's Chris Hemsworth, obviously. The other character is the super calculated guy. And what I love about this flick is just it's like the ultimate enemy battle throughout the whole movie. There's several other things that I really liked about the flick, but let me talk about the director before I get too into the flick. So this is my second favorite director. It's Ron Howard. Ron Howard, if you're listening, I'm sorry. Tim Burton just barely beat you out. But when you think Ron Howard, T-Man, do you think Rush, or what movie do you think of?
That's a great question. With Ron Howard, there's a lot of films. It's not maybe just one film. He's got a lot of really good films I like, but if you had to pick one, it'd be Apollo 13. That's
correct.
That's one of my favorites, and that's my favorite of his for sure.
I think everybody in the audience, if they would have asked me, they would have probably thought I fell in love with Ron Howard when I watched Apollo 13. And it's not like Big Fish. I actually did watch Apollo 13 first. But space was always something I cared about. My son Jack, like, always talks about wanting to be an astronaut, is fascinated with space. And me too. I'm fascinated with space. And so I loved Apollo 13 from my first viewing. Like, and it is a hoorah. Like, I love Tom Hanks in that. But what's different about this movie is it's not something that I was fascinated with, but because of this movie, I became fascinated with. And I would challenge anybody that watches this movie. This is my challenge, Real Talk community. If you can do this, it's like the Pringles challenge. If you can eat one Pringle, you're amazing, because nobody can do that. If you can watch this movie and you cannot look up anything about the 1976 Formula One circuit, you're a better man than I am. Tommy, did you look up anything about, like, the Grand Prix or Niki Lauda or anything after you watched this film?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Well, you know, with movies like this that, you know, I don't know a lot about the history of it, you know, because like you, Gabe, I'm not a Formula One fan, and I didn't know anything about it. So after I watched the film, which I also really, really enjoyed and love, I looked up kind of all the events around it and looked up, and because I just want to see how accurate it was and all of that type of stuff.
There are some scenes in this movie, and I don't want to ruin it because there may be, I would encourage fans, if you don't know anything about it, don't look it up. Watch the film first, then look it up, and that will be more fun. But there are some visceral scenes in this. It's a lot like First Man, where it's almost like a character study of these racers and what it would take to actually be a Formula One racer. It's not something I would do. And in the description I read, it's like they're strapped onto bombs going 200 miles an hour down a track. And that's really what it was, because they were trying to cut weight off these cars so that they could go faster. And what Ron Howard does that's really cool in this film is the perspective of the racer in the situation. There's a scene where they're racing in the rain, and it is horrifying what they can actually see. And you try to like put yourself in the car and what that person sees. Well, you get to see that from Ron Howard's view. And that's why I like Ron Howard so much, is he's able to put you in those situations and like no other director has ever done. One other thing that I really love about this movie, before I get into the interaction between the antagonist and the protagonist of the movie, is how it's all laid out. Like, it's not going to immediately hit you with action. There's relationships. There's a study into how it all happened. There's a study it's just such a good movie. But the very, very best part, and I'm about to say it, Chris Hemsworth and Daniel Brühl, their rivalry really makes you get on the edge of your seat. There's multiple times during the film where, like, I'm watching the race, and I'm cheering. I'm standing up. I'm clapping because the rivalry, they have made the rivalry so intense that you are rooting for one of the two racers. So, you know, I don't know. I don't want to ruin a lot. But one other thing I will say before I kick it over to my co-host is there are two scenes between Chris Hemsworth and David Brühl that are just interactions, and they're at the end. There's one at the very end, and there's one right before the end where they're talking, and they're just conversations. But what I will say is they are some of the best scenes of two actors acting, and their conversations are some of the best written conversations that really make you think about life, that make you think about, you know, what they're going through, and make you think about your enemies. But simultaneously, it's an action-packed movie that will leave you on that edge of your seat and make you feel like you're in a bomb racing at 200 miles an hour. And that's what I want in a film. So what do you guys, have you guys seen the movie? And if so, what do you think?
Let me give you just a little bit of a history. And I think that it will make sense for what I'm going to say. My family, up with my stepdad and my step-grandfather, who I just referred to as my dad and my grandfather, they were big race fans. My dad's friends were race fans, big NASCAR fans, and pretty much anything with a motor. Now, me, I've always been a little bit different. I've been more, you know, I'm into other things. I'm into sports. I'm into movies, more so than engines and things. However, I was exposed to a whole lot of it growing up. And what I've learned, I don't really care about racing. I don't care about the sport really at all. But what I've found over the years is that the stories about racing, the stories themselves, are some of the most interesting stories that we can pull from the sports world. This is a little bit unfair to Rush, because I was just really indifferent after I watched Rush. And this is why. There's a documentary that came out in 2010, which I saw before the 2013 movie Rush. It's a movie called Senna, and it's actually just a documentary. And Formula One really has the most interesting racing stories, even more than NASCAR and IndyCar and some of the others that Americans are more familiar with, because Formula One is truly the world's sport of racing, whereas NASCAR is America's racing. But there are just so many great stories. And the story of Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost, his antagonist, or if you're a Prost fan, Senna, Ayrton Senna was the antagonist. That story is so much like the real story of James Hunt, and I can't think of the other driver's name, but that rivalry was very similar. However, Senna is a real documentary, and it plays out a lot like the movie Rush. Rush, in my opinion, is shot really similar to how that documentary was. I'm not saying that Ron Howard truly went out and borrowed from the documentary, but I could probably make that argument. And seeing the cinematic version, where although it is pretty, even some people that were involved said, yeah, they did a really good job. It's pretty similar. they did embellish the rivalry between these two men just a little bit. And there are certain scenes that they added in that's just for cinematic. They didn't really happen. Whereas the Ayrton Senna and the Alan Prost, that was incredibly real. They hated each other, and they were so good, both of them, and they went back and forth, back and forth. Ayrton Senna is considered the greatest Formula One driver ever. And what he could do driving in the rain, they said no other driver that's ever lived was able to drive a vehicle like Ayrton Senna could in the rain. It's like if it started raining during the race, it was over. Senna was going to win every single time. And the character, James Hunt, the real guy, went down the same path as Ayrton Senna. They are just so familiar. James Hunt died at 45 back in 1993. Ayrton Senna died in his early 40s the very next year in 1994. And so both of these guys were these huge, like, basically Hollywood stars of racing. Both of them good-looking guys. Both of them were all about the women and the partying and the money and being out on the yachts and all that type of stuff. And then their protagonists, Alan Prost and then the other driver that's in Rush, they were very same, both very calculated, both very strictly about the racing. Although they were almost as good as both of these other guys, they were not the Hollywood version that everybody loved and wrote about. So I guess that was my only problem with Rush, and I have a hard time recommending it because there is this amazing real documentary, real footage, real everything. They even have the crash in it where Senna died. He died in a car crash. The same weekend as another Formula One driver died in the exact same curb and curve that they did not fix, and it killed the sport's biggest star. So that's not fair to the movie. And I understand that, but that's why I just was kind of lukewarm because I saw it so quickly after seeing Senna, and Senna just blows it away, in my opinion. So I'll stop talking now. That was way more than what I wanted to say, but I just wanted the audience to understand where I was coming from and not being a big fan of the movie.
Well, let me respond to that before we go to Tommy real quick. And I agree, and crazy thing. So I went down the wormhole of Formula One racing after watching it. And immediately afterwards, I watched Senna. So I've seen Senna but I did it in the reverse order of what you did. But my argument to that would be, so yes, you're right. They were friends. They were actually seen out in clubs and stuff, but in the movie Rush, they were James Hunt and Niki Lauda were actually friends. And he was Lauda was the calculated one. Hunt was the one who, in fact, it is a fact that he, in his biography, he bedded 5,000 women in his lifetime, he claims. And he had a special affinity for airline stewardess and indulging alcohol, marijuana, and cocaine. James Hunt and Niki Lauda did not really trash talk so much, but they were polar opposites. So I've seen Senna, and while it's more rooted in fact, and while I like that part more, I think the racing scenes and the cinematography in this and Ron Howard's direction make it so you don't care. It's so awesome. Like, you don't care because he's made this story great. I think if you're rooted in the trueness of the sport, you may have a hard time with it. But if you're not, like I said, if you haven't read about it, watch this movie because it will make you fall in love with it. And then it will make people want to watch it. Tommy, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I'll just say, you know, I love Rush. I've seen it a couple times since it came out, and I'm not like you guys, I'm not super huge into racing, and I don't even know if I like any other racing movies other than this one and the one that came out last year with
Ford
Matt
versus Ferrari.
What was that one called?
Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah, I love that one too. I actually kind of consider them similar. I think couple of things of why I love Rush is, like you said, Gabe, about the visceral direction of the filmmaking. That's really fun. But, you know, one thing I was thinking about when I watched it last time is I always just like movies where there is that protagonist and antagonist relationship where they're both competing for something and they're making themselves better. And neither one of them are bad guys. Like, you can root for both of them. Both of them are fine.
Yeah.
And there's lots of movies like that, but it's always kind of, it's always a good go-to, I guess you could say. Like, it's something like if you see a movie like that where you have two characters who are kind of frenemies, I guess you could say, and they're pushing each other to a goal. I feel like that's just like, there's always good stuff in that. And I think that's one aspect of Rush that I really like, is the relationship battle that they have, that you end up rooting for both of them. And then by the end, you get that emotional payoff of what you were saying, Gabe, about the relationships and stuff like that. So yeah, I would recommend it. I think, Wes, to your point about Santa, I think, yeah, it's definitely a good point. But I think for just like a general audience, especially for interest in racing, I think Rush would definitely satisfy your needs of like, hey, you know, I just want to watch a drama that has like a lot of, you know, just a lot like First Man, where it's one of those films that they don't make a lot anymore. It's one of those mid-level dramas that actually has characters, drama, stakes to it, humor. It has a lot of things going for it that I think audiences would appreciate.
Well, I'll end it with a quote from the movie, and I'll butcher this because I didn't write it down. I wrote it down from memory. The closer you are to death, the more alive you feel, and that's the only way to live, and I love it. And that was said by James Hunt. And I, part of the things that I like in the movie is the writing, and I think that quote is spectacular.
So there you have it. That's our first Movies We Love episode, and we'll bring these to you every now and then. It's just a good time for us just to, I've really enjoyed personally talking about the movies I love and kind of on the edge of my seat a little bit with what you guys were going to pick. So I think that's pretty cool. And just to remind the audience, this is what we've recommended you go out and see. Fright Night from 1985, Dog Soldiers from 2002, Big Fish from 2003, Rush from 2013, Last of the Mohicans from 1992, and First Man from 2018. So again, please, if you check out any of these films, we would love to hear from you. Let us know your thoughts. If you've already seen the movies and you just want to reach out to us and tell us what you think, do that as well. We love interacting with our listeners. For new listeners, guys, we're trying to grow the show. We're trying to reach a larger audience. A couple of things you can do to support our efforts. Number one, subscribe to our show and leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcast directory. Number two, follow us on social media. That's the best way to interact with us. We're on Twitter at Real_cast. That's R-E-E-L. We're on Facebook, Real Talk, a movie podcast page. And finally, if you have a suggestion or an episode that you want to hear, send us an email with those details. Again, we'd love to hear from you. That's realtalkmoviecast, all together, @gmail.com. And for us, that's a wrap.